Good evening. Welcome to the Project for Deeper Understanding. Tonight we'll be discussing wildfires and how they might affect Summit County in the future. I was inspired to start this little discussion by one of our constituents who I was pouring beer for last fall when the fires were going on in the Northwest and in California, and she asked me a pointed question: can it happen here? And that's one of the things we're going to try to discuss tonight. I'm going to start off with a short 15-minute video from a forestry professor who's going to explain to us why the forest fire situation has gotten so much worse over the last few decades.
As you've probably noticed, in recent years, a lot of western forests have burned in large and destructive wildfires. If you're like me, this western landscape is actually why my family and I live here. And as a scientist and a father, I've become deeply concerned about what we're leaving behind for our kids and now my 5 grandkids. In the U.S., an area that's larger than the state of Oregon has burned in just the last 10 years. And tens of thousands of homes have been destroyed. Acres burned and homes destroyed have steadily increased over the last 3 decades. And individual fires that are bigger than 100,000 acres, they're actually on the rise. These are what we call mega fires. Mega fires are the result of the way we've managed this western landscape over the last 150 years and a steadily warming climate. Much of the destruction that we are currently seeing could actually have been avoided. I've spent my entire career studying these western landscapes, and the science is pretty clear. If we don't change a few of our fire management habits, we're going to lose many more of our beloved forests. Some won't recover in our lifetime or my kids' lifetime. It's time we confront some tough truths about wildfires and come to understand that we need to learn to better live with them and change how they come to our forests, our homes, and our communities. So why is this happening? Well, that's what I want to talk to you about today. You see this forest? Isn't it beautiful? Well, the forests that we see today look nothing like the forests of 100 or 150 years ago. Thankfully, panoramic photos were taken in the 1930s from thousands of western mountaintop lookouts, and they show a fair approximation of the forest that we inherited. The best word to describe these forests of old is patchy. The historical forest landscape was this constantly evolving patchwork of open and closed canopy forests of all ages, and there was so much evidence of fire. And most fires were pretty small by today's standards. And it's important to understand that this landscape was open with meadows and open canopy forests, and it was the grasses of the meadows and in the grassy understories of the open forests that many of the wildfires were carried. There were other forces at work, too, shaping this historical patchwork. For example, topography, whether a place faces north or south, or it's on a ridgetop or in a valley bottom. Elevation, how far up the mountain it is. And weather, whether a place gets a lot of snow and rain, sunlight and warmth. These things all worked together to shape the way the forest grew. And the way the forest grew shaped the way fire behaved on the landscape. There was crosstalk between the patterns and the processes. You can see that in dry forests, trees were open grown and fairly far apart. Fires were frequent here, and when they occurred, they weren't that severe. While further up the mountain, in the moist and the cold forests, trees were more densely grown and fires were less frequent, but when they occurred, they were quite a bit more severe. These different forest types, the environments they grew in, and fire severity, they all worked together to shape this historical patchwork. And there was so much power in this patchwork. It provided a natural mechanism to resist the spread of future fires across the landscape. Once a patch of forest burned, it helped to prevent the flow of fire across the landscape. A way to think about it is that the burned patches help the rest of the forest to be forest. Let's add humans to the mix. For 10,000 years, Native Americans lived on this landscape, and they intentionally burned it a lot. They used fire to burn meadows and to thin certain forests so they could grow more food. They used fire to increase graze for the deer and the elk and the bison that they hunted. And most importantly, they figured out if they burned in the spring and the fall, they could avoid the out-of-control fires of summer. European settlement, it occurred much later, in the mid-1800s. And by the 1880s, livestock grazing was in high gear. And if you think about it, the cattle and the sheep, they ate the grasses, which had been the conveyor belt for the historical fires. And this prevented once frequent fires from thinning out trees and burning up dead wood. Later came roads and railroads, and they acted as potent fire breaks, interrupting further the flow of fire across this landscape. And then something happened which caused a sudden pivot in our society. In 1910, we had a huge wildfire. It was the size of the state of Connecticut. We called it the Big Burn. It stretched from eastern Washington to western Montana, and it burned in a few days 3 million acres, devoured several towns, and it killed 87 people. Most of them were firefighters. Because of the Big Burn, wildfire became public enemy number one, and this would shape the way that we would think about wildfire in our society for the next 100 years. Thereafter, the Forest Service, just 5 years young at the time, was tasked with the responsibility of putting out all wildfires on 193 million acres of public lands, and they took this responsibility very seriously. They developed this unequaled ability to put fires out, and they put out 95 to 98% of all fires every single year in the U.S. And from this point on, it was now fire suppression and not wildfires that would become a prime shaper of our forests. After World War II, timber harvesting got going in the West, and the logging removed the large and the old trees, and these were survivors of centuries of wildfires. And the forest filled in, thin-barked, fire-sensitive small trees filled in the gaps. And our forest became dense, with trees so layered and close together that they were touching each other. So fires were unintentionally blocked by roads and railroads. The cattle and sheep ate the grass. Then along comes fire suppression and logging, removing the big trees. And you know what happened? All these factors worked together to allow the forest to fill in, creating what I call the current epidemic of trees. Go figure. More trees than the landscape can support. So when you compare what forests looked like 100 years ago and today, the change is actually remarkable. Notice how the patchwork has filled in. Dry south slopes, they're now covered with trees. A patchwork that was once sculpted by mostly small and sort of medium-sized fires has filled in. Do you see the blanket of trees? After just 150 years, we have a dense carpet of forest. But there's more. Because trees are growing so close together And because tree species, tree sizes, and ages are so similar across large areas, fires not only move easily from acre to acre, but now so do diseases and insect outbreaks, which are killing or reducing the vitality of really large sections of forest now. And after a century without fire, dead branches and downed trees on the forest floor, they're at powder keg levels. What's more, our summers are getting hotter, and they're getting drier, and they're getting windier. And the fire season is now 40 to 80 days longer each year. Because of this, climatologists are predicting that the area burned since 2000 will double or triple in the next three decades. And we're building houses in the middle of this. Two recently published studies tell us that more than 60% of all new housing starts are being built in this flammable and dangerous mess. So when we do get a fire, large areas can literally go up in smoke. How do you feel now about the forest image that I first showed you? It scares the heck out of me. So what do? We need to restore the power of the patchwork. We need to put the right kind of fire back into the system again. It's how we can resize the severity of many of our future fires. And the silver lining is that we have tools and we have know-how to do this. Let's look at some of the tools. We can use prescribed burning to intentionally thin out trees and burn up dead fuels. We do this to systematically reduce them and keep them reduced. And what is that going to do? It's going to create already burned patches on the landscape that will resist the flow of future fires. We can combine mechanical thinning with some of these treatments where it's appropriate to do so and capture some commercial value and perhaps underwrite some of these treatments, especially around urban areas. And the best news of all is the prescribed burning produces so much less smoke than wildfires do. It's not even close, but there's a hitch. Prescribed burning smoke is currently regulated under air quality rules as an avoidable nuisance. But wildfire smoke, it simply gets a pass. Makes sense, doesn't it? So you know what happens? We do far too little prescribed burning, and we continually eat smoke in the summers from mega fires. We all need to work together to get this changed. And finally, there's managed wildfires. Instead of putting all the fires out, we need to put some of them back to work, thinning forests and reducing dead fuels. We can herd them around the landscape when it's appropriate to do so to help restore the power of the patchwork. And as you've probably figured out by now, this is actually a social problem. It's got ecological and climate explanations, but it's a social problem. It'll take us humans to solve it. Public support for these tools is poor. Prescribed burning and managed wildfires are not well supported. We actually all simply want fires to magically go away and take that pesky smoke with them, don't we? But there is no future without lots of fire and lots of smoke. That option is actually not on the table. Until we, the owners of public lands, make it our high priority to do something about the current situation, we're going to experience continued losses to megafires. So it's up to us. We can spread this message to our lawmakers, folks who can help us manage our fires and our forests. If we're unsuccessful, where will you go to play when your favorite places are burned black? Where will you go to breathe deep and slow? Thank you.
I have two more quick slides to show you here. Here's a quiz. What are we looking at? You got it, Summit Park. Google satellite view of Summit Park. This one you probably don't know, but you see a housing development there with fewer trees than in Summit Park, but with a lot of trees around it. And that is Santa Rosa, California, before and after. So that's our motivation for our discussion tonight. I'd like to start with getting our panel to introduce themselves. Name, tell us a little bit about yourself and why you're concerned about this particular issue. And we're going to start it on the stage left there with John Blazard. Go ahead, John.
Yeah. My name is John Blazard, lifelong resident of Summit County. My family have lived in the Camas Valley. I think I'm fifth or sixth generation now. My great-great-grandfather and his son, which would be my great-grandfather, were sawmillers and cattle ranchers. They raised their cattle in Bountiful and pastured them in Camas Valley in the summer. They also sawed lumber in the mountains east of Camas and hauled that lumber to wherever it needed to be. They made shingles, they made lumber for barns, houses. And my grandfather had a box plant in Camas, and he built ammo crates, shoe boxes, candy boxes, egg crates. During World War II, he ran his plant 24/7, trying to supply the needs for the War Production Board. And so we have a long history of harvesting timber and turning it into useful products. We also have a cattle ranch in Camas Valley that we, I guess you could call us public lands ranchers, because we graze our cattle on the national forest in the summer, and we graze them on BLM ground in the winter. I think I have a pretty good understanding of the value of renewable natural resources. The forests above Camas are still, as near as I can tell, old growth forests. They've never, a lot of it has not been touched. Some of the places that we've logged and removed timber, the process was just to remove a little bit each year. 30 years later, go back and take a little more selective logging. We love the mountains above Camas. We know that with the beetle infestation up there that there's a very, very real possibility that we could have a really huge mega fire in the forests in our county. My family live, all but one of my kids live in Camas Valley, and they want to continue to live there and be able to make a living there. So that's what we do.
I'm Daniel Howdige. I'm the district ranger for the Heber Camas district. I started my career back in 1997 down in Salt Lake. And so I've spent time in Ogden, Logan, Mountain View, Evanston, and Camas before they merged. And in 2007, I left Camas and went to work for the Forest Service in Texas. I spent 10 years there. Now, when I left, I remember hearing about the beetles. I remember seeing a few dead trees here and there. I came back here in January of last year, and I was utterly amazed at what I came back to. So looking at our district, 80, 90% may be dead. I mean, it's a big chunk. And seeing the challenge that's ahead of us, it's it's overbearing when you really start to come out there and look at it. When we look at capacity, when we start looking at available tools, where do you start? Where do you begin? And so to me, at least, the importance that the Forest Service sees, or what I see when I go out there, is a lot of what is produced out there is the watershed, the health of that watershed, the water, which is very important here to the Forest Service. So as we move forward, as we start to look at things, I'm really interested today to listen to any kind of questions, and just know that we believe the Blazers are one of our best partners out there. And so John and I are going to probably work in side by side here for quite some time as we look at this. And so we're glad to be here today.
Thank you, Daniel.
Hello, I'm Chris Crowley, the Summit County Emergency Manager. I was born and raised in San Francisco, so I've lived through a few terrible disasters, the 89 earthquake, the Berkeley fires. I came to Utah, though, as a major event planner to plan one of the greatest events, the Olympic Games here. Fell in love with the area, of course, and now I plan for emergencies, which is a good thing, I think, because I know that we can put together great plans and we can keep our community safe if we work together. But it's also a bad thing because we have to think about this and we have to be worried about it. It's a very serious issue, and one that I hope that this evening's discussion will lead to bigger and better management of our forests and planning within our community.
Hi, I'm Darren McAvoy. I'm an Extension Assistant Professor of Wildland Fire and Forestry at Utah State University. I've been here for about 20 years. I'm a former member of the Flathead Hotshot Crew in northern Montana and a veteran of the Yellowstone fires. I fought fires for about 15 years and was an ignition boss of prescribed fires. I've been associated with fire my whole career. I actually hosted Paul Hesburgh here last year for the Restoring the West Conference, and that's what got him into Utah and his era of mega fire tours. I represent the Southern Rockies Fire Science Network in Utah, and we put together field trips, and I publish the Utah Forest News. Encourage you to Google that and get on our mailing list if you're interested in these topics. I've been writing about it quarterly for all the time I've been working here. Our next wildland fire tour will be, I think we're just starting to plan it, will be July 7th, looking at the Bryan Head Fire and looking at how previous management activities, harvesting and thinning around that area affected the fire and the fire suppression response in those days. So I encourage you to check out our website at forestry.usu.edu and find a lot of information about these things. Thank you.
Thank you, Darren. Your presentation with Paul Hesburgh last fall was what motivated me to get into this particular topic.
My name is Mike Owens. I'm the fire marshal for the Park City Fire Service District. I've been involved in the emergency services since 1999. I have been an employee of the Park City Fire District for about 13 years now. In that time, I've served both as fire marshal, my current position, and also as a firefighter. I joke with the firefighters now that my job is to make sure that they don't get to do theirs. As part of my responsibilities, we manage a crew of chipping personnel whose sole responsibility is to mitigate fuels around the Park City Fire Service District areas, which has been pretty successful. I'm originally from Oregon, which a little town called Roseburg. If you walk through Home Depot, you're going to see some lumber that says Roseburg on it. That's my town. I come from an area where logging is a big deal, and it's an important part. So I get to see this from both sides, and thank you for having me here tonight.
My name is Ryan Torsicolo. I own a local tree service here in town. I've been doing tree work for about 11 years now. First started doing it in Colorado, working on the pine beetle out there. So I have firsthand experience seeing just how much destruction and how many trees it can kill in forests. I moved here about 5 years ago now, and I've watched the forests up in Samick and Summit Park slowly get more and more and more brown, just watching the trees die from it. And yeah, I see every day up in the mountains, Colony, Deer Valley, Summit Park, the amount of deadfall everywhere in people's yards, standing dead, and no one's really doing much about it. There's the selective few, but I definitely think, you know, informing the general public more about it and really knowing what can happen and what will happen if you, you know, leave it versus take it out is definitely very valuable, and people really need to be informed about, like, what can happen here. Thanks.
Bryce Boyer, Summit County Fire Warden with Utah State Forestry Fire and State Lands. I've been in the county as the fire warden for 15 years now. Prior to that, I was on hand crews, engine crews that traveled all over the West doing wildland fire as well as project work in communities. Coming to Summit County, a lot of the job changed from being firefighting to the educational side of it and trying to get the word out on the need for defensible space, doing community wildfire preparedness plans, and just in general educating elected officials, business owners, and homeowners as to the dangers that are out there. Also, part of the job is being a liaison with the other agency folks, Forest Service, BLM, to help coordinate when we have the larger fires and the resources and interests on both sides. I've been in wildland fire for probably about 25 to 30 years at this point and enjoy that job. Also, I'm enjoying moving into the doing more of the prevention and trying to educate folks on best practices and ways to help prepare for a fire event.
Thank you, panel. As most of you know, we've had a historically low snow year. We got snow, snowpack is at all-time lows for this time of the year. What that's going to do is going to lead to the forest drying and the soil drying out much faster than normal. As Professor Hesburgh said in his video, seems like the fire season in general in the West has expanded by 40 to 80 days over the last few decades. And while our fire season here isn't as long as the rest of the West, I don't think, it has possibility of affecting us, particularly in June, July, and August. So I'm going to really break this discussion up into two general categories. One is the wildland-urban interface, where we have our residents living within the forest area, and the second area will be about general forest management and what we can do in the long term to make our county safer. So my first question is, to any of you who want to pick it up, is what does a fire-safe environment around a house look like? Who wants to start with that one? Go ahead, Mike.
I'll go ahead and start there. So I think fire-safe is a very dangerous word or a very dangerous couple of words to think about or to say, because even when you've done everything, there's still going to be little things that can catch you unaware. So fire safe may lead you to some complacency, but be fire prepared might be a little bit better
Good.
Way to look at it. When we talk about preparing our homes for any type of fire prevention, we want to look, of course, at plants. We want to look at the landscaping around our homes, the trees that are close to our homes. And Bryce has actually got some really good stuff on that. But there's a lot of other bits and pieces to that as well. You want to make sure your home is buttoned up. If you have parts of your home that stick out, make sure that underneath of those you're not having brush collect. Make sure your decks are clear. Make sure that you have easy access to your home and you have good water supplies. Those are the things that are going to keep you more fire prepared than anything else.
Anyone else want to address that?
Oh, in general, in that field, I've gotten to do some post-fire inspections and look at homes that had burned down in the Bitterroot Valley and other places with Jack Cohen and some of the the world sort of specialists and that sort of thing. And Jack likes to say it's the little things that make a house burn down. It's not really the big wall of flames that cause most homes to burn down. It's the embers. It's the flying firebrands that can be as small as this and as big as this. An active, strong wildfire will create its own weather, pick up those large chunks of wood, and can deposit them miles away out in front of the fire. It's been known to happen. I've seen it happen a lot of times. And that's how fires tend to travel. So think about where those embers might land, and think it's the same place where your real concern spots are. It often can be cleaned up with a rake and a shovel and a garbage can. It's where those needles gather in the corner of the deck or up on the valley of the roof up above. And when an ember lands in a spot like that, then your whole house is really prone. And it can be not just the home, but things attached to the home as referred to, even the fence. If a fence is attached to the home and that fence burns, it'll lead right up to the home. So make sure you have breaks. And in general, we recommend an area about 30 feet away from the home with the kind of plants that you referred to, the more fire-resistant plants. And then there's zones, 60 feet and 100 feet out for defensible space. And again, on the USU Forestry Extension website, we've got lists of how to do that and lists of recommended plants for Utah in particular that are more fire-wise.
As well, there's a couple of handouts that's on the table by the windows on the right in the rear. One of the brochures is from you folks with the FireWise distances, some of those Utah native plants and plantings that can be done in your yards and so on. Again, it's not typically the fire front that takes out a home. It's typically the fire or the embers behind cracks, crevices, where those embers get in, where people have stored stuff under decks and don't have, you know, where grass and pine needles and leaves are going to accumulate. Those are the same places that your embers are going to accumulate. And just want to advise y'all, there are the brochures in the back on defensible space and so on. In the back, please help yourself to those.
So from an emergency management perspective, I look at prevention and preparedness from two perspectives. First, I work with these agencies to make sure that if we do have a large fire or any other emergency, that we can bring in additional resources from other areas, other locales. But on a more important and certainly more important from this perspective is that community and personal responsibility that we all have to mitigating against fires, preparing our families, friends, neighborhoods, communities to avoid emergencies and hazards of all types. And that really starts, again, with that personal responsibility, the acknowledgement that we do live in an area that's both beautiful and dangerous, that sometimes those trees that you have growing right next to your house aren't the best idea. And it is, in fact, your responsibility to protect your community and your family and your home by either taking down those trees or taking steps to make sure that you reduce those hazards in and around your home.
Anybody else? To follow up on one of Chris's comments, being responsible citizens in our community, what are the typical fire starters during fire season? What can we do to prevent the fire from starting in the first place?
I'll tell you, one of the biggest ones is fireworks. We love our fireworks. We love our 4th of July. We love to see the Big Bang. My daughter's 4 years old, and she gets more excited than you can imagine. She loves those fireworks. Unfortunately, my son is 13 years old, and so does he. we've fought several fires here in the Park City area that were caused because kids were shooting off fireworks. It's a common thing. Fireworks will get you. There's this thought that they go up hot and they come down cold, and that's certainly not the case. Anything that goes up in the air hot then explodes is going to come down and land on the ground hot as well. And if you're doing that in the wrong place at the wrong time, then that will certainly lead to events that none of us want to see.
Some of the other larger contributing factors are agricultural burns, debris burning, piles, leaves, that kind of stuff. Folks not paying attention to what the winds are doing, what kind of humidity is out there. And as in the video with doing controlled burns, for us as agencies, there are also rules and regulations by air quality for you folks as homeowners, ranchers, and so on. They're a little more lenient on the ranching side when you're looking at fences, ditch lines, and that kind of thing. But when it becomes piled, limbs, trees, that kind of thing, the air quality regulations are still in effect for that kind of burning. We've posted a lot of that information because it is one of the larger questions in the county of when they can, when you can't. On the summitcounty.org, under government, it's on the fire warden page, along with a lot of links to dragging chains or some of the other ones, not maintaining vehicles or trailers, and bearings coming off, wheels coming off, chains dragging from vehicles. There's a lot of those that get started in this area of the in the county.
Good, thank you. What kind of resources do we have available for homeowners and for businesses to prepare the land around their either dwellings or businesses?
The county offers a free chipping program, which is available through the County Public Works at this time. To schedule that, it typically runs through late June to late August, and that can be scheduled to have it come out and chip brush. There are also guidelines on how to pile that brush. You can't pile it with machinery, because these are going to be people coming out to pull it apart to chip it. If you've piled it with machines, they're probably not going to get it pulled apart. There's a lot of information on the summitcounty.org / fire warden page, with links to FireWise Communities, the brochures for One Less Spark, One Less Fire brochures are there with information on how to limit those types of fires.
Here in the Park City Fire District, we run a chipping program that's also free of charge, that's meant for homeowners to help clean up their land. You will be able to sign up on our website, www.pcfd.org, starting May 15th. Once we get your name on the list, we will be starting a circuit around the county. Our chipping services will start June 1st or June 4th. As we do our circuit, we'll pick up your piles. If we miss you around the first time, it's no big deal. We'll catch you on the second time. We've had some changes to our program this year. We're no longer limiting the number of piles that a single person can have chipped. We'll chip you every time we come around. It's free of charge. We want to help you get those limbs out of your yards. We do need you to do a little bit of the work. We need you to bring the branches to the street. But you know, also on top of that, we have one of the members of my fire prevention staff will come to your homeowners associations, and he'll talk to your homeowners association about what your homeowner needs to do what the homeowners need to do to prepare your land. He'll help you. He'll teach your homeowners association how to recognize problems. He will go to your house and he will help you recognize those problems, and then show you how to show your neighbors how to take care of those as well. So we try to get to everyone that we possibly can, and we really want to work with the homeowners associations on this, because we know that working with big groups of people that can work its way down is going to
make a much larger difference than if I just have one person out there trying to do all the work himself.
Kind of on what Mike was saying, I think it's super wise. You can just call a tree service for two different things. I mean, one, sometimes trees are big. You can't get them down yourself. You need a little help. So for those ones, a tree service can help, or you can be preventative on it. And, you know, out here we have a lot of evergreens, and with the pine beetle running rampant and the fir engravers or the fir blossom beetle as well, they're killing firs and spruces left and right. So if you get out and you stay proactive on it and spray your trees and just kind of look for stuff like that, it's going to help you in the long run because your trees aren't going to die. So, I mean, those are two good preventative things to do as well.
To follow up on something Ryan just said, we just have a new fact sheet. There's a new insect in Utah called the balsam woolly adelgid that's likely to hit fir trees pretty hard. It's killed 70% of the alpine fir, subalpine fir on the Payette National Forest. It's been in Idaho for years, and it's just new to here. It's just finally been confirmed this year. So you can look on our website for that fact sheet and a series of them on balsam woolly adelgid. Wanted to bring up a new idea, a resource that's not quite available yet, but I'll have to work with these guys to make it available. I'm doing this work in other parts of the state now. And I didn't mention earlier, I'm the chair of the Utah Biomass Resources Group. I co-founded that group in 2010. And I work hard on trying to marry utilization of waste wood, which is what that's about, with fire and fire prevention and reducing hazardous fuels. And my latest project that way is over the last year, I've introduced these very simple kilns. They're called Oregon kilns or flame cap biochar kilns. It's just a metal box that's 5 foot by 5 foot and 2 foot high. And we put branches in these, and we can burn we can extend our burning window. We can burn much closer to buildings. We can burn later in the season and earlier in the season. I'm getting smoke air quality exemptions and doing these kilns. I've done 6 or 7 demos around the state now. The first one was in May of last year in Draper. And I've got, again, on one of my websites, utahbiomassresources.org. I've got videos and instructions on these kilns. And you don't have to even use these kilns. I've done demonstrations with just old cattle troughs and working with somebody here on doing this sort of thing in pits. And to just quickly point out, so our product at the end of the, so we put a bunch of branches in there, we can reduce the volume, the size of the kiln, you can put, depending how dry it is, 5 to 10 times the volume in there and burn it down. And when it turns into all coal, hot ashes, put a bunch of water on it, like 80 or 100 gallons. And that preserves those coals. We're making charcoal, essentially. And this is a product called Biochar. It's fairly new. I could talk about it all day, so don't get me started. Mm-hmm. But it's essentially a soil amendment. It's like putting a million little sponges in your soil. It increases water holding capacity. I've got a dozen studies going on in Utah around this topic.
So again, from a community planning perspective, I work very closely with Bryce and the other foresters here to make sure that we're getting the word out to our community and our citizens that they can't just start burning whenever they want. They have to pay attention to the weather conditions, and certainly to if you're going to have a large fire, that we want to make sure that you let the, at the very least, sheriff's dispatch know you're going to do it. Better yet, get a permit. And watch out for those red flag days. Please don't burn there. And again, it's a community responsibility. And I realize that I'm speaking as the emergency manager, but what I've been doing in my neighborhood just recently is cutting down trees that are close to my home and using that as a method to reach out to my neighbors to alert them of their dangerous situations. And what we're doing is making piles in our neighborhood so that we can call Park City Fire District or the county when the chipper program is available, and we'll have piles available, and hopefully we'll end up with a safer community. Now, I also want to bring up something about the beetle kill, because this is something that's, I feel like I'm a jinx, because I come from a place where I've been in earthquakes and fires, and now here I am in Utah, and we start to have beetle kill. I happen to have a family cabin in the Sierra Nevadas, and the beetles have absolutely devastated the forest in our area, but not unlike the video showed, our forest is very thick in the Sierra Nevadas, and it hasn't necessarily been logged. In fact, when I was a kid, there was a lot of logging, and I would say for the past 20 to 30 years, there's been almost no logging. So I think that that's probably, I can't say definitively, but it could definitely contribute to not just the beetle kill, but we've had a couple of close calls with fires as well.
That's a great segue to bring in our Forest Service and loggers. Let's talk about the Uinta National Forest. What do you consider the health of our local forest right now?
It's dead.
That was a quick answer, John.
From my perspective, there used to be 7 or 8 sawmills in Camas. Camas mm-hmm. was one of very few communities in the United States that was considered to be totally dependent upon the national forest for their economy and for their livelihood. Today, we're the only sawmill left. And I can tell you the reason why. It's because for the periods of years, like was just mentioned, the allowable cut or the amount of timber that the National Forest put up for sale was very, very limited. It was like 1 to 1.5 million board feet per year. Our sawmill has a capacity of, it used to have a capacity of 6 million feet per year. But because of the shortage of allowed sale of timber, we downsized our operation. We shut our sawmill down in the summer and cut logs, and then we saw those logs. So our total output of board foot of lumber is considerably smaller than it could have been. And that's why the other sawmills have gone out of business, is because there just wasn't enough wood available to keep us all running. And as a consequence of that, the timber got older and bigger and denser and thicker, and now it's deader. We spent a lot of our time weeding the forest, taking out the high-risk trees, the trees that were less desirable to look at or genetically inferior, crappier lumber, but that's what we did, and that was the management strategy for the forest. It was more of a preservation strategy than it was a management strategy, and in doing that, we preserved all the big, beautiful spruce trees, which were of tremendous value, and now those great big trees are the trees that the beetles love to eat, and so they're all dead. The bigger the tree, the longer it's been dead. But the amazing thing is that there are a lot of young seedlings that are growing up underneath that dead forest. If we can remove those dead trees before they burn, those little young seedlings are going to have a chance to create a new forest. If it burns, everything's going to be dead. Then we'll have a forest that's all of the same age, and then we're just destined to do this over and over and over again.
Mm-hmm. Dano, your comments on that?
I guess I can second John. I mean, be honest with you. I mean, that's the situation that we're in right now. We talk about it a lot in our office. You know, you push a domino, what's going to happen at the end? And again, here we are. 7 mills used to be there, used to, you know, be ramped up to be able to accept what the Forest Service was putting out. We toned it down. They made their adjustments, and now we're in a situation where it's completely reversed. I can't turn on capacity overnight, and so that's kind of the situation we're stuck in. And I agree, you know, the big challenge that we have right now is If we don't get those trees out, or at least start to treat some of those dead stands and those overstory trees, they eventually fall down. And if we do get fires inside those stands with that amount of fuel load, you're talking about you're wiping out a whole entire stand. It will not come back. I mean, you're superheating the ground with the amount of large trees on the, you know, sitting there like that. So we're stuck in a situation now that we need to come out and look at it from a different perspective, different eyes. And really what I look at is no idea is a dumb idea.
Good. I like to hear that.
Just point out that this is a West-wide problem. I spent today and the last few days with wood utilization specialists from around the West. We happen to have a meeting here in Park City the last few days, and the same story from Idaho, from Washington. Mills are closing down, not enough supply.
Talk a little bit about, you know, Dano and Darren and about the Brian Head Fire and what a similar occurrence might do to Summit County.
Scary thought.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a frightening thought. I've led a few tours on the Brian Head Fire. I don't know. It's interesting talking to local folks about it, that did it burn in the beetle kill? How much of a component was that fire? And you talk to the local district ranger who was the district ranger and now is with the state and has been for a million years. He's always lived there. And he'll tell you it was all the beetle kill. And I talked to one of my researcher colleagues down the hall, and he says, no, it wasn't any beetle kill. And so where is the truth? And that's part of the purpose of this field trip. And the Division of Forestry, some of your counterparts, Bryce's, excuse me, counterparts have put together GPS accounting of what and when the beetle kill burned, and it was a component of it. So it's a frightening thought. Be prepared. Listen to the advice from your local specialists on preparing your home. And if there is an evacuation order when that happens, get out and get out early. A large number of people who die in wildfires are those who try to evacuate too late. And if you wait that long, you're better off just sheltering in place a lot of times, because you just can't drive through the smoke. You can't see, you can't breathe, and you get very easily disoriented in that situation.
Hang on 1 second, Dano. I've been given the signal from KPCW. It's time for our nearly 8 o'clock station ID, and this is the Project for Deeper Understanding on KPCW Park City. Dano, you're up.
So I don't ever like to sit and say nothing will ever happen. When I first got back to this district, folks used to talk about it being the asbestos forest out here on our side. You know, big spruce, holds a lot of water, we're wet and so forth like that. Coming out of Texas, we're very humid over there. And for about 3 or 4 years, we had a drought. And I always talk about it as the moon, the sun, and the stars lining up. And when it goes, it goes. And unfortunately, I'd like to say that, you know, it's not always a lightning strike that starts these fires. As we see more and more folks coming out to us now, spending a lot of their time in the forest during the summertime, it more than likely could possibly be a man's start on there. And again, the big fear for us, the reasons we have to look at and talk about management and so forth is, you know, we may have to give up a little bit to save a lot more out there, and really that's our challenge as we go and look at that. So I'm never going to sit here and say that we will never have a Brian Head, but I don't want to sit around and not plan that we wouldn't. So
I'll have to say, when I attend the UAC conferences, Utah Association of Counties, and I spoke to some of the county commissioners from the area around the Brian Head fire, and one of the biggest takeaways I got from them was the destruction of the watershed. The watershed in the town of Panguitch was trashed. You know, our national forest in Summit County is a watershed for about 600,000 people on the Wasatch Front. Pretty much everybody in Summit, Morgan, Davis, Weber, and part of Box Elder County are relying on the waters flowing out of our forest up here. So it's not only going to be the devastation of the forest fire, but the after effects on the watershed and the entire economy of Utah could be tremendous. We are at the one-hour mark, so if anybody has some questions they'd like to ask our panel, you can start filing up to the mic. I have some more questions that I can feed them while you're thinking about it, but please come on up whenever you're ready.
Hi, I live in Park City. I want to know the status. I heard that the Utah legislature was moving forward to limit the number of fireworks allowable, I guess, displays or privately in July. So I wanted to know if you can give us an update.
I'd be glad to. The Utah State Legislature this year passed a law that reduced the number of days that fireworks would be allowed to be shot off by the general public. That does not reduce the number of days that we can have large displays by licensed people. However, instead of 3 days on either side of a holiday, it's now been reduced to 2 days before and then 1 day after. So instead of being 7 days, it's now been reduced to four.
Very good.